from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. A year ago, President Trump drew sharp criticism for calling himself a nationalist at a rally in Texas.
You know, they have a word. It sort of became old-fashioned. It's called a nationalist. And I say, really, we're not supposed to use that word. You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay?
But according to conservative commentator and National Review editor Rich Lowry, nationalism is not a dirty word. Instead, he says nationalistic impulses are natural and a product of Americans' shared culture and political interests. Lowry joins us to discuss his new book, The Case for Nationalism, and we'll also get his take on this week's public impeachment hearings. It's all coming up next after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Rich Lowry, the editor of the conservative National Review, thinks nationalism is getting a bad rap. In his new book, The Case for Nationalism, he argues that nationalism is not inherently racist or hateful. Instead, he says it's a natural impulse reflecting a group's common history and culture. He joins us this hour to talk about why he thinks nationalism has been an animating feature of American history from the Revolutionary War to the present, and why both the right and the left should accept it as part of today's political discourse. And we'll get his take on the impeachment inquiry. Welcome, Rich Lowry. Good to have you with
Thanks
us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess maybe the place to begin here is let's get a semantic, as close as we can, definition of what we mean by nationalism, because sometimes in many people's minds it seems to merge with chauvinism and with American exceptionalism and particularly with patriotism. So when you're talking about nationalism and you're defining it to some extent as separate from civic nationalism, ethnic nationalism, and so forth, I mean separating those kinds of nationalism, what do you mean?
Yeah, so first let's go to patriotism and nationalism, because very often people will argue that patriotism represents all that's good in national feeling and nationalism all that's bad. Patriotism, its root comes from the Latin patre, same root as patriarchy, fatherland. It's basically loyalty to your own. Nationalism is a more specific idea. It is the doctrine or notion that a distinct people united by common culture, common language, common history should govern a distinct territory, and it defines the modern world where we are a world of sovereign nation states.
Well, that's certainly a working definition. I wonder, though, about the fact that Jill Lepore, who I know you have a good deal of respect for, major historian who's been on this program and who you actually mention in your book, says that the difference between nationalism, for example, and patriotism is that patriotism is animated by love and nationalism by hatred.
I don't see how that's possibly true. In the American Revolution, for instance, the motive of the American Revolution at bottom was that the American nation, which I believe preexisted 1776, I can't give you a specific date, but we had our own institutions, colonial assemblies and habits and mores that developed independently in this country for more than 100 years. The basic claim of the American Revolution was that the nation had its own rights and claims that should be vindicated, and it should govern itself. I don't see how that possibly is motivated by hatred. And the example of the American Revolution has obviously inspired similar revolutions or attempted revolutions in centuries going forward. And just the idea that you should govern yourselves is a basic instinct and isn't hateful at all. It's natural and should be, to the extent it can, you know, there are always fringe cases, should be respected.
Well, I'm just wondering about, because when I first started studying international relations, it was presented to me that nationalism was really behind the two great wars of the 20th century. And I think that's axiomatic, isn't it? That, I mean, it's a core belief. And we come to when we study international relations. So nationalism has been also not only in the past identified with or linked somehow to violence and war, but also to fascism. And even today, one could argue that many of the dictatorships we see are nationalistic dictatorships, whether it's Viktor Orban in Hungary or Erdogan in Turkey.
Yeah, so nationalism obviously can be abused and ill-used, and it has been. I'm not a scholar of the causes of World War I or even the causes of World War II, but it seems clear to me as a basic proposition, yes, nationalism played a role. Serbian nationalism precipitating event in World War One has always been malign, conspiratorial, shot through with violence. But the basic factor in World War One was that the Germans wanted to rule Europe, which crosses a line from nationalism to imperialism, and certainly Nazism. If Hitler were just a nationalist, he wouldn't be Hitler.
His party was called the National Socialist Party.
Right, but you wouldn't say, I assume, that, well, Bernie Sanders can't call himself a socialist because Hitler's party was National Socialist Party. No, I mean, Bernie Sanders is not a Nazi, right? There's a distinguishable difference, same way there is
with
Hitler
nationalism. All about Deutschland über alles and all that nationalistic feeling for Germany? Germany had been, you know, essentially trounced on by the Allies after World War One. Therefore, they had to come back and be a unified nation.
But it was this cracked racial vision of an Aryan-ruled Germany and an Aryan-ruled Europe. So it was really kind of a vision of an SS neo-imperialism that is part of a long line of imperial dreams for ruling all of Europe. Runs through Charlemagne, runs through Napoleon, runs through Hitler, inspires in certain respects the EU today. Obviously, the EU is a much more benign and mild form than all the rest of those projects. But the powers that defeated Hitler were small d democratic nationalists, FDR, Churchill, de Gaulle, who believed strongly in the goodness and in the sovereignty of their own countries and defended them and vindicated them, thank God.
We're talking with Rich Lowry. He's the editor of the National Review magazine, also author of The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. And I'd like to get into that history and bear down with you. But recently, you got a very nice Valentine. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, said he loved your book and recommended it to people and so forth. I'm trying to connect this, if I could. Help me just historically within the moment, because the National Review in 2016 came out with an issue, was very opposed to Trump, said he's not fit for the office, said he was racist and xenophobic, basically. And
we didn't say that.
Words to that effect, at least I remember the article, and it may not have used those words, but it certainly said that he was unfit for the office. You would agree with that?
Poorly suited. And this was during the primaries. We very strongly opposed him when there were 16 other better, in our view, Republican options. And now we're much further down the road.
I think you used the phrase racial scapegoating and also egotistical and a number of other things that suggested this he didn't have a character for the presidency.
I'm sure we did use the word egotistical.
Well, let's go there for just a moment, because now have you made a pivot here? Most Republicans, most conservatives now support Donald Trump. And I often think about people like your predecessors, Bill Buckley, Bill Rusher.
Yep.
I think they would have been horrified by Trump, don't you?
I think Bill Buckley would have been horrified by the personal conduct. I don't know where he would ultimately be on Trump. He was a brilliant guy, idiosyncratic guy, hard to predict on any given issue or political figure. But this is where I am. So 70 or 80% of what Trump has done substantively, I support, which is surprising to me. It's higher than I would have thought. He's been a rock on really important things to conservatives, pro-life issues, conscience rights, obviously judges. And one reason I was nervous about him is I thought he'd be totally up for grabs on those sort of things. I'm still appalled by a lot of the things he says and does that no president should say or do. But I don't – at this point, there's not much of an alternative. You know, the alternative is going to be Biden or Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg, all of whom all their policy I – oppose, and some of them, certainly Elizabeth Warren, I think probably represents a longer-term threat to our constitutional system than Donald Trump does, because Donald Trump will say, you know, wild things on Twitter. Elizabeth Warren is frankly promising to do things that are either illegal or highly constitutionally dubious, and one of my frustrations in the current moment is on the left we have a very strict sense of institutional propriety and the separation of powers. only when it applies to Donald Trump. No one's appalled that Elizabeth Warren says she's going to ban fracking unilaterally despite the fact it would violate a 2005 law. No one cares that her wealth tax is probably unconstitutional. No one cares that she has no authority to break up the tech companies. So there's an enormous element of
hypocrisy. As long as we're talking
here.
About constitutional impropriety, I might as well get you on the impeachment because you've written about it and you said that it's an undertaking. I'm reading somewhat in the subtext here. It's probably not going to go anywhere. And it doesn't reach the enormity of, let's say, what ought to be impeachable. And let's keep in mind the fact that this is just an inquiry and impeachment is just an indictment. But nevertheless, you've taken that position solidly.
Right.
But the president has clearly, in many people's minds, violated the Constitution, and not only with respect to Ukraine, but in so many other ways. Let me get to something here that I think has been weighing on me after reading your book.
Sure.
That is, you talk about American memories, and you really hit a chord with me on this. That is, when we stand up and sing the Star Spangled Banner, put our hand over our heart, we feel very connected as a nation. This is
right.
What you're pretty much getting at in your view of nationalism. We hear Land of My Father's Land, of the Pilgrim's Pride, all these kinds of things, beautiful for spacious skies. What do we do with the fact that we have a president who lies more than any president ever has lied, and lies more, one could argue, maybe even than many of the autocrats he admires so much? And I simply ask this in a plain way. When you think about kids growing up, didn't you grow up honoring the memory or the myth of George Washington never telling a lie, Honest Abe Lincoln? These are warp and woof of our DNA as Americans.
Yep. There's no doubt about it. The way he conducts himself is often abysmal. And at National Review, we call it out. If I don't call it out personally, someone else is calling it out, or we're calling out in our pages or on our podcasts. And I mean, there are a couple big problems with Trump's presidency. One, and this plays into the Ukraine thing, is an insufficiently developed sense of the separation between himself personally and his office. He doesn't really see any separation of those two things.
And the United States of America. I don't know if he sees a separation there, does he?
And he doesn't think institutionally or constitutionally. So these are major pitfalls. I would disagree with you about how he's violating the Constitution constantly. I think there have been a couple things. The redirecting of military funds to build the wall, certainly, at least in spirit, violated the way our system's supposed to work, and we called him out on it. We opposed him very vigorously. I've been in public debates where I've opposed the administration's position. But I think it's a mistake to, as some people on the left do, say he calls the press the enemy of the people, which he shouldn't. Therefore, he's violating the First Amendment in some sense, which he's not. These are words and sentiments that under a constitutional system a president can say. It's just that he shouldn't. It's not that it's illegal or unconstitutional.
What about abandoning our allies, the Kurds, who fought valiantly against ISIS and so forth, or for that matter doing – when you talk about nationalism, it may be in opposition to this idea of isolating the United States. Macron recently, as I'm sure you're aware, said NATO is brain dead now because of Trump. I mean, put the blame on Trump and made Trump culpable.
Yes. Yeah, so the pullback from the Syrian-Turkey border, again, we opposed it vigorously, and I think it was a foolhardy decision. Trump's defenders will say, well, the Turks wanted to come and we only had 50 guys there and weren't going to stop them if they were going to come. But you could have stood them down, as he had repeatedly prior to a couple months ago on this phone call with Erdogan. And one of the major downside of this decision is it puts at risk what was a foreign policy triumph, which was the destruction of the caliphate, which is a policy that he had a ball he had taken from Obama and carried forward. He'd been more aggressive about it, and the killing of al-Baghdadi. And the problem is now we have people policing northeastern Syria who are not as interested in keeping a boot on the neck of ISIS as we are, most importantly, Russia.
And, putting it mildly.
Yeah. And but also, again, just the hypocrisy point, President Obama stood by while hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered in Syria. And in his red line fiasco, he invited the Russians into Syria. So they're there because Obama invited them there. So, again, I'm fully on board opposing President Trump's pullback from Syria. But that position also logically implies a very strong criticism of what Obama did. And just my problem in the current moment is no one is consistent on these things. So you have a lot of Republicans
what they call
who
a
are
yes,
very,
but argument, Rich.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of Republicans who are very critical of Obama, and then will find a justification for what Trump did. There are a lot of folks on the left who are excoriating about what Trump did, but will support what Obama did. But neither of these positions add up. So I think at National Review, we've been consistent. We were excoriating about Obama's Syria policy, and we've been excoriating about what Trump did a couple months ago.
Well, I started by asking you about the impeachment proceedings, and I want to pursue that a little with you because I'm looking at a quote from an article you did where you said, "It will blow a hole in the legitimacy in the center of our national politics that would take years to heal." Many would argue that's what Obama did, that's what Trump has done.
Well,
I'm not saying
I think,
Obama should have been impeached or Trump should not be impeached. I'm just saying that both of them as presidents, especially since you mentioned the red line, did things that are execrable.
Yeah. So, well, all presidents do at least a little of this execrable, given human nature and what politicians are. My position on impeachment, it was improper what happened. The focus on the Bidens was completely inappropriate. And clearly, we were leveraging the defense funding to try to get them to make a statement about investigations. Now, this didn't actually happen, which I think should affect what we consider the appropriate punishment. They get the defense funding. They don't make any statement. And I just think, given in this populist moment, given how our institutions are kind of people have a dim view of our institutions more than ever before, that if a presidential reelection that the president has some significant chance of winning is short-circuited because 20 Republican senators say he should go, this will not be a good outcome. It will not increase trust in our institutions. It'll be worse for our country.
So are you saying if a crime is not successful, it's okay?
No, I'm saying you'd consider the punishment. And this wasn't a crime. It was an inappropriate act, but it was highly ambiguous. It was highly contested within the administration. One reason it wasn't carried out. And I think a lot of people on any given day who are at the center of this process, you could have given them a lie detector test and said, what is the United States-Ukraine policy? And they wouldn't have known because there are some people who are trying to get them to commit to investigation. There are other people saying, this is crazy. What are you doing? Don't do this. Rethink it. And at the end of the day, it just didn't happen. So the analogy I make from the Mueller report is Trump's order, a purported order to his then White House counsel, Don McGahn, to fire sideline Robert Mueller. And there's some dispute actually what was said, but McGahn clearly took it as an order. He's like, I can't do that. I'm going to resign. He starts packing up his stuff in the weekend, and other people around him are like, no, don't do that. This is crazy. Stay. And Trump doesn't follow through, so it doesn't happen. So should he be impeached as if he actually fired Robert Mueller just because he had the thought and the intention at a certain level of doing it, but it didn't happen? No. And I think Ukraine's a lot like that.
And when McGahn and all of the others, including, well, whomever, you can go down a long laundry list, refused to appear in front of the House of Representatives, your thoughts? I mean, in a sense, they're doing something that at least technically is illegal, aren't they, by suborning depositions not being given?
I think it just depends on the case. And there is such a thing legitimately as executive privilege. And I think when you get the Ukraine matter, when you get to Mulvaney and John Bolton, people having direct conversations with the president, that's where a claim of executive privilege is going to be strongest. And Bolton, of course, is litigating a slightly different issue, which is this notion of testimonial immunity, where the belief is the president can't be called in front of Congress because that would be a violation of the separation of powers, and that there are advisors to him that are so close to him, so caught up in his ambit and his powers that they also can't be called before Congress. This hasn't been litigated extensively. I think there's just been one decision on it that left some opening that was sort of took a dim view of this theory but left some opening for when it involves national security, which Ukraine would. So I would disagree with you just to a blanket statement that if these type of advisors don't testify that it's somehow untoward.
Would you disagree also with the positing that your book maybe even suggesting that there's something – really invidious about diversity and what some would call mongrelization, that this is a real danger. I use that word advisedly, of course, but what comes across is a concern about national heritage that goes back to, well, British roots more than anything else. It's in your book, East Anglia,
and the
King James Bible and all the rest of it. Where does that fit in terms of America being a nation of immigrants and a nation that is seen as diverse and that has, you know, for example, you say we celebrate Christmas holiday, but we don't celebrate or make a holiday of Yom Kippur. As we said when I grew up in Cleveland, or the distinction between, let's say, Cinco de Mayo and July 4th.
Yep.
So where does diversity come in your vision of nationalism? Where does it fit? Yep. Where does immigration fit?
So a couple things. One, there have been several very hostile reviews of my book, none of which have taken issue with any of the history you glancingly mentioned, that immigration from East Anglia, the settlers coming from East Anglia, eastern part of England, into Massachusetts Bay kind of left a key cultural imprint on Massachusetts Bay and therefore really the entire country going forward. But my contention is that there's a cultural core of this country that's very important. It's organic and open. It does change over time, but there's a core of it that doesn't. And the molten core of that, I would argue, is the English language. Common language is highly important to national cohesion. We've seen this throughout history. We've seen it just in recent decades. I cite this example in the book. Canada is really a nice, pleasant place. Not very much bad happens in Canada, but it's nearly torn apart by the fact that Quebec is a French-speaking province plopped into the middle of this English-speaking country. And in large part because of that, Quebec tried to become an independent nation and tear the country of Canada apart. We see this contention in Spain and Catalonia, where they speak to a large extent their own language. So maintaining the English language and its dominance here is a really important thing. And this does not make us a closed system. Immigrants come here and learn English. They have across centuries. They become Americans. They absorb our mores.
Some become citizens. Some want to keep their soccer team as, their lodestar and follow essentially their home countries and whatever that means, I think. I mean, that's what makes America diverse too, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't have a problem with people following their sports teams back in their home countries. I just want this and this is an example I use in talks is to try to get at what I'm saying from another angle. Hypothetically, if there's an African American who meets a white American on the steps of the Paris Opera House tonight, they instantly have more in common than anyone else around them because they share a language, they dress largely the same, they eat the same kind of food, they have a huge stock of common cultural references.
Let me just go to a major omission of that, though, and that is because we'll come back to this in a moment. Actually, I'll come back to it. I'll tease the audience with this because I want to talk with you at least a bit about 1619, which you've written about. And we're talking to Rich Lowry, and he's the editor of the National Review, author of The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club today at noon. And you can talk to him and, in fact, raise any questions or concerns you might have or join our conversation. The toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or you can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Rich Lowry. He's the editor of the National Review magazine and author of The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. And I was mentioning 1619 before we went to the break, and that's, of course, when many have looked at, and this is where you have argued rather strongly, I think, against the idea that we should look at some of our heritage as tied to slavery. And you go to great lengths to show how slavery, even the word of slavery, is avoided, Northwest Territory Ordinance and all of that. I won't get into the details here, but it was a forceful argument and a salient one. The real question in my mind, though, is when you talk about, say, an African-American and an American who goes back to, let's use President Trump's favorite nation, Norwegian roots or whatever, and they're going to the opera or whatever, they have more in common, granted. But they also, there is a difference, there is a specter, if you will, of slavery.
Yeah.
They are the sons and daughters, many of them, of slaves. There's a big argument now about, you know, those from the Caribbean and Jamaica, if they should be included and so forth. But you know what I'm asking here.
Yeah. So I think one of the great ironies of American history is you cite an example of an immigrant from Norway. If that's the white American who meets the African American on the steps, the African American's likely, unless his family emigrated fairly recently, last several decades, to have a much longer lineage in this country than that Norwegian American, than any European American, certainly than any of the hideous neo-Nazi marchers in Charlottesville. And one of the I objected to important aspects of the 1619 Project, one really moving thread in the lead essay of the 1619 Project that I thought is absolutely correct is just the theme of how American African Americans are. And the author wrote about how when she was a little girl and one of her friends, African American friends, are at school, and there was a project that was meant innocently, where the teacher wanted the students to come up and point on the globe to the country where they're from. And they didn't know, right? Because they were so American and they had been here for so long. So I would correct a little bit what you said at the outset of this part of the discussion, where you said, we're not tied to slavery. I would say we're not defined by slavery, but certainly slavery is part of our history. What I object to is lying about it, and to have an enormous project on slavery and the history of it in America and not note that in 1776, the American Revolution wasn't about slavery. In fact, it created a time of relative openness in terms of slavery and race relations, where you had states in the North embracing gradual abolition of slavery. You even had the South opening up in certain respects. Now, there's horrific backsliding later in the 19th century. And one of the essays in the New York Times actually suggested there was a, quote, property in men in the Constitution, where there was a debate at the time whether to include that phrase. And James Madison and others said no, because they feared that would create a stamp of legitimacy for the institution of slavery that they wanted to avoid, because they thought in the long run, and it was much too long a run, obviously, that slavery would dissipate and end in this country. It didn't without a civil war. Even after that, the rights of blacks in the South, obviously,
and there's something denied, in our Constitution also, though, about three-fifths of a man.
Yeah, they made a compromise with the South in a way that was does not stand up well under our contemporary standards. But if the option was to have a unified country or to have two countries, one of which was slaveocracy, I don't think it would turn out any better for anyone if the latter had been the option. And the North ends up – the free soil North ends up overwhelming the South and destroying the institution of slavery. And that's a very good thing, but it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't been a united country to begin with.
Well, we are a united country now, certainly post-Civil War, but we are not united in terms of political polarization and enmity of what one could easily define as one group against another. I just want to, before we go to our callers, ask you a question on impeachment. Also, President Obama, what would have happened if he had been pressured had been pressuring a foreign leader and saying, I want you to look into Donald Trump Jr. and his sons?
Well, everything would be reversed, right? Democrats would be wrestling to find a way to excuse it, and Republicans would be condemning it. I mean, that's just sort of the partisan dynamic in our country now. I'll give you another example. Supreme Court is hearing arguments about DACA today. That's an instance of President Obama just frankly writing immigration law on his own in a way that's
it was bipartisan, though.
He wrote the law on his own. There wasn't a vote. The problem was he couldn't get it through Congress, and he repeatedly said correctly, I don't have the authority to do this on my own. And then he's just like, I'm going to do it on my own. There wasn't one peep. I don't remember one peep from one center-left commentator saying he doesn't have the authority to do this. I would understand saying, look, I support the policy, but he doesn't have the authority to do this. No one said that. So the problem is that the and this is one insight of James Madison that ended up being wrong. He thought Congress would be very jealous of its prerogatives, all the branches would. Congress hasn't been very jealous of its prerogatives because when a Democratic is in the White House, all the Democrats are fine with an overwhelming executive power. And when Republicans in the White House, all the Republicans are fine with the same. So I think there's a very bad trend in our national life. But let's not pretend it's just one side that's guilty.
Again, we're talking to Rich Lowry, and his new book is The Case for Nationalism. And our first caller is Don from San Jose. Don, you're on. Morning.
Thank you. Yes, I am not sure that I agree with the language issue. There are countries like Switzerland, which have four national languages, have had a vibrant nationalism for centuries. I'm an English-speaking Canadian from Western Canada, and I highly value the French-Canadian contribution to our culture. And I think it would be a terrible thing if Quebec were to leave Canada. Although I do understand their issues. I think a modern nationalism should unite different diverse languages and cultures. This is what we have in the United States today. We should embrace this diversity.
And what do you say to that, if I may ask, Rich Lowry?
Yeah, Switzerland is the exception that proves the rule. It's the example everyone comes up with because it's among the few examples you can come up with. And the fact is Canada was nearly torn apart by Quebec wanting to go its own way because it has its own culture and language. So I'm saying if you can avoid that, you should. And there's not anything exclusionary or overly inexacting in just expecting people to come here and speak the language, which by and large they want to do. So our institutions and educational system should be helping to do that and should avoid so-called bilingual education, which is often functionally just a way to help people hold on to their native tongues rather than learn English.
I think that conservative argument seems to have won. Let me get some more callers on here. We're talking again with Rich Lowry and go next to Alex. Alex, you're on the air with us. Good morning.
Hello. Hi, Rich. In your book, you state that nationalism is the opposite of the quest for dominion over people and territories. So I'm wondering what you feel about America's westward expansion and whether you regret how we didn't permit the other nations or people already living in America to have their own governance and their own territory.
Yeah, this is clearly a major national sin. We were duplicitous, we were cruel, and to stain on our national honor. I say that in the book repeatedly. What I also say, and I think is inarguable, or at least I haven't really heard any good counterarguments, is that it was a stupendous boon to this nation that we ended up a continental country with that extent and power, and it would have drastically limited our influence in really important ways that are very good for the world if we weren't a continental nation. Well, we wouldn't have contributed, I believe, to winning two world wars in the 20th century. And the fact is if we had been just limited ourselves to huddling against the eastern seaboard, someone would have taken over the rest of the continent and pushed the indigenous peoples aside, whether it was the Mexicans or whether it was the Canadians or whether it was the British or the French or the Spaniards or some other European power. So I think that, again, we should have honored our treaty obligations, but unfortunately it was somewhat inevitable.
A little strain of Machiavellianism in that, isn't it? The means justify the ends?
No, I'm not saying might makes right because I'm not saying it's right. But I'm saying it would have happened one way or the other. And, when Mexico had California and a huge swath of Western territory, unfortunately, the native peoples were not doing any better than they did when we took over these territories. There was just inevitably a cultural clash. I wish it had been different. But to defend their territory, ultimately, native peoples would have had to defend their borders and stop white settlement. And I just don't believe they had the power or means to do that.
Coming up on the anniversary of the attempt to take over Alcatraz, any thoughts about that?
I am not. You've hit. We've had a wide ranging conversation going across the centuries in contemporary politics. Now,
wait
you,
till
got,
the, wait
now
till
you
the,
cornered me.
Well, wait till the next hour. We got Tommy Mansari on, who's written a history of 50,000 years. But let me get some more callers on, and I want to read some comments. We'll get Noah on next. Noah, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi, thanks. I want to challenge this whole notion that nationalism is not tied to racism. Nationalism involves rallying around, you know, a political, social, you know, environment. And, this national entity was built by and for white males and continues to work best for those people and doesn't really work for many other sects of society. So I think that's why you can't really separate the two, because people who are arguing for nationalism are arguing for the system that's been set up in this country for its whole existence. And so it sounds like a very white male perspective to say that nationalism is great.
Thanks for the comments, Noah. Yeah, we'll go to Rich Lowry.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I would say a couple things. It was initially people ruling this country thought it would be a country for white people. But there is also very important seeds that developed into a greater sense of liberty and a greater sense of openness. And I think if you look at the swath of American history, it was the nationalists who are better on this question than the people who were consumed by a swollen and bogus sense of states' rights or who supported a spurious Southern nationalism in order to defend the institution of slavery and subsequent to that, the institution of Jim Crow from the national authority. One of the worst trends in the most portentous developments, I should say, in the 19th century is John C. Calhoun, Southern statesman, started out as a nationalist. I'm a war hawk. We're going to have a strong military. We're going to build internal improvements to create a nationally connected country. Then his home state gets consumed with opposition to the tariff, and he becomes a South Carolina patriot overwhelmingly and creates this theory of nullification that plays into ultimately Southern secession. So all things considered, you'd want him to be a nationalist rather than the alternative. But again, race is a stain in our history. We still feel its legacy today, and I support reasonable policies that do not have a major downside or unintended effects to help lift people up in this country of all races.
Let me thank Noah for the call and read some comments that are coming in. Matthew writes, World War II was not won via nationalism. In fact, it was won through multilateralism and the ability of the Allied powers to rise above nationalist instincts. Steve says or asks, this book seems to me to be ill-timed, semantic hair-splitting. We have other words that express the concept without being so close to the racial taint that nationalism has today, such as patriotism. Why did Mr. Lowry think it was important to rehabilitate this word now?
Well, I think, one, the notion that it's inherently a radioactive word is just clearly wrong, so that needed to be cleared up. And I don't think patriotism accounts for the fact that we're a distinct, bounded political entity that should protect its sovereignty and pursue its interests. That's something distinct from patriotism, and is certainly distinct from patriotism as it's commonly defined very often as just a national feeling about ideals. We're more than just an idea.
Well, here's Arter writes, nationalism can easily be a cover for the concept of us versus them. Nationalism is currently embraced by those who fear the other to the point of shouting, you will not replace us. Please name some nationalists you admire and why.
Alexander Hamilton, most influential founder besides George Washington, who's the taproot of American nationalism. We're going to have strong and capable national government, which is why we get the Constitution. We're going to have a strong Navy and a strong military. We're going to be a great power like Great Britain, and he loses out the political struggle to Thomas Jefferson, who's better at small-D democratic politics, but his vision of the country prevails and makes us better for it. Abraham Lincoln, who fights to preserve the American nation-state in part on the basis of and that wonderful phrase that echoes through our history, the mystic cords of memory, all these sort of cultural attachments.
All our historical icons. Can we think of anybody in our contemporary world that fits that bill?
An admirable nationalist?
Yeah.
The Brexiteers in Britain, I think, are kind of my ideal of nationalists. I think the EU is a quasi-imperial project with a serious democracy deficit, that England is one of the most, if not the most stirring example of self-government in world history, and that it should be governed from, to some large extent, from Brussels rather than Westminster is a scandal to me. And I hope they break loose and become totally autonomous again.
Well, it's certainly become a paradigmatic example to many of our own populace, and they revere it and they celebrate it. And I'm just wondering how far this should extend. I mean, particularly when you think about those who talk about the deep state and they speak nationalistically about our government being taken over, and they believe our government has been taken over by a swamp.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that phrase. I don't use it. I can't remember an example of using it. I think it applies much more to a country like Turkey, which is the source of that phrase. There are clearly elements of the bureaucracy that can't stand Trump, that resist any Republican president because the bureaucracy is not a conservative in its viewpoint or attitudes. So I think that is a problem in terms of self-government. I think certainly the administrative state's problem in terms of self-government is taking on the trappings of the other branches, legislative and judicial. That's a big long-running problem, kind of a generational challenge.
Don't we have a bigger deficit now than we've ever had? And wasn't it always kind of a major issue for conservative Republicans like yourself not to have this deficit? It just keeps running away, which means bureaucracy and government are running away. Doesn't
yeah.
It?
So when I said at the outset when we're talking about Trump, you know, support 70-80%, this is another thing where just the fiscal element has been cast aside and we're running nearly $1 trillion deficit at a time when the economy is going pretty well. So what does that say is going to happen when inevitably we hit a bump in the road and have a recession again? So I think this is a profligate policy that's very unwise. We've run editorials about it. We've run cover stories about it. But what we've seen, my frustration was in the Obama years, very often all congressional Republicans would say is that we need to reduce the deficit and reduce the debt. And we at National Review would say, OK, yeah, you know, we agree with you, but that's not really an agenda that speaks to most people who have real concrete, you know, cost of living concerns and other issues. So you need a wider and different agenda. Now they've gone totally in the different direction and totally jettisoned all of that. I don't think it needs to be the overwhelming, like, only issue Republicans talk about it, but it needs to be a quiver in their arrow. And it will become again, you know, inevitably if, say, Elizabeth Warren wins the presidency and pursues her policy of government spending and aggrandizement, but there'll be much less credibility around it than if Republicans had maintained more consistency on this over the years.
More of your calls. Jerry, you're on. Morning.
Hi. Let me preface this by saying I am a white male combat veteran of the United States. However, when I hear people talk about nationalism and this being a quote, white country, it makes me wonder what they think the value of the other races are, such as the children being separated from their families on our southern border. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, I've never said this is a white country. I totally reject that notion. I think the American culture has many influences, and African Americans have been a key part of the cultural nation from the very beginning.
But is nationalism putting kids in cages, and that argument has been made, for example?
No, I think nationalism, and this is something
maybe it's a toxic nationalism, but it could be a nationalism, couldn't it?
Well, so I think nationalism, at the end of the day, it's quite basic. So our trade policy, our foreign policy, our immigration policy should be forged with our own interests and the welfare of citizens and people who are already here foremost in mind. Now, there's a big policy argument about what policies meet that test. And you have liberals and conservatives disagreeing about that. But there's a baseline of nationalism to you if you accept that that should be the test. Now, the child separations ended up being a debacle. They shouldn't have happened. They, in theory, it was a way just to discourage further migration by prosecuting the adults who had come over illegally. And in theory, you know, you'd prosecute them in the courtroom, then you'd reunite them with their kids and everything would be fine. Instead, the kids were separated into this institutional maw that would send them off, you know, halfway across the country without the adult knowing where they or the parent knowing where they were. So this was unsustainable. It wasn't sustained. It was ended and reversed. And that was a low point in the Trump presidency. I think now through other means, he's actually managed to get his hands around and diminish the migration crisis at the border. That's a good thing. But the separation policy was a big mistake.
Some pushback. David writes, nationalism is not the same as Nazism, but you could not have had Nazism without it. And Stephen writes about DACA. Rich Lowry made a definitive comment that Obama's DACA program was illegal. It should be noted that legal opinions are divided on its legality, and no court has ruled that it was illegal. And here's Mike, who says nationalism was a characteristic of the Republican Party between World War I and World War II, the Johnson-Reed Immigration Quota Act, the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, and non-interventionists like Robert Taft. This seems very much like President Trump's nationalism today. Is it the same?
Yes, that's a very good, very good point. Actually, no one's on a book tour. You get used to like everything, except you've Michael, you've asked some questions I hadn't gotten before, and they're very thoughtful. But this is a very good point that I'll have to think about and absorb. What I would say is kind of my nationalism goes back to Hamilton. Trump definitely is more of a vein that goes back to Andrew Jackson, and there's a huge element of populism mixed into it, and that you don't get in just the Hamiltonian tradition. But the caller or the emailer raises a good point.
Another email with an interesting point and a question from Jackie. He says, I've lived in the conservative South and liberal San Francisco. Besides speaking English, I don't see any cultural similarities between areas of the U.S., so what are the similarities that define nationalism besides language? South is another country in many people's minds.
It's a big, diverse country, and I wouldn't want to change that and impose some sort of uniformity. But in the South and in San Francisco, you celebrate Thanksgiving, right? You honor the flag, the same flag most of the time. You honor the same founders and heroes, although you might have different emphases on what they are. And you do, like it or not, share a common history. So I'm all in favor of variability and, regional distinctiveness is part of what makes the world go around. But there still is a core that unites us all.
Let's get Thomas on. Thomas, you're on. Morning.
Thank you, Mr. Krasny. I've never called a radio station before, but I don't think that Mr. Lowry's comment about the Brexiters being admirable should go unchallenged. They are in the tradition of English nationalism that has had a long centuries of bloody history. And you may detect that my accent is Irish, but that's not my motivation for calling here. I just think that the Brexiters are reprehensible, and many of the leaders of Farage is a racist. And
you're having a little hard time hearing it, Thomas. I'm sorry. No, that's okay. But I'd like to hear Rich Lowry's response. I mean, basically saying, you know, the Brexiteers are not what we should be looking at in terms of approbation.
I don't think they are racist. I don't think 52% of the UK is racist. I think the fundamental motivation here was having control over its own destiny, including immigration policy, and there's nothing wrong with that. But look, the English do have their grievous national sins, obviously with regard to Ireland, and then also British colonialism, which may have been better than some other forms of colonialism or colonialism by other countries, but was still wrong. And this, there's contention between FDR, who's a more thoroughgoing nationalist, and Churchill, over this, you know, during World War II, where FDR thought, you know, Churchill just had a, as he put it, a Victorian attitude about this, where the British should still rule these other nations. And again, it wasn't sustainable. And as soon as the element of coercion lightened a little bit, you have nations united by their common history, common culture, common language, rising up and saying, you know what, we're going to govern ourselves. And they said it to the British, they said it to the French, they said it to the Soviet Union. Going back further in history, they said it to the Habsburgs, they said it to the Ottomans, they said it to the earlier Russian Empire. So I think that the nation state is the most natural political unit, and it should rule itself rather than being ruled by others.
Again, Rich Lowry with us. He is the author of The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United and Free, and will be at the Commonwealth Club today at noon. Quick response from you on a comment from a listener. Says, my concern is that his view is inextricably part of a racist, violent continuum. He may have a nuanced argument, but social movements are more blunt, and dark forces a la Charlottesville find comfort and encouragement from views like his. He is like the gentle approach leading to the nastiness we saw in Virginia.
I reject that wholly. White nationalism is a contradiction in terms. Even though, you know, our founders had their major racial blind spots, to put it mildly, they weren't neo-Nazis. And neo-Nazis are a tradition that whose DNA really has runs through the KKK and other domestic terrorist groups. It doesn't have anything to do with the mainstream of the American national tradition. And loyalty to the nation and a feeling, a national feeling, it's above sect. It's above tribe. It's above race. It's above ethnicity.
So does it matter that Jefferson and Washington were slaveholders, yes or no?
It matters to our history, but that obviously is not the best of America or what we are going to become.
Good note to end on. Rich Lowry, thanks for joining us. Good to have you.
Thank you. A very thoughtful conversation. I really appreciate it.
Rich Lowry is the editor of the National Review Magazine, author of The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free, and he'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco today at noon. Thank you for being part of this hour. Another hour ahead with Tommy Mansari. We're going to talk about 50,000 years of history. Stay tuned for that.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.